You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Greetings, everyone. It's Fran here, and I'm joined in the co-host chair again this week by Reverend Dr. Sally Douglas. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Fran.
So Sally, if you recall, is a New Testament scholar and Uniting Church minister at Richmond Uniting Church and has been a guest on By the Well or a host multiple times. So this week we come to Pentecost 18, and there's a richness we'll be dealing with this episode, beginning with Esther, chapter 7, verses 1 to 6, 9 to 10, chapter 9, verses 20 to 22, though we will be talking about the whole story. We'll be looking at James 5, 13 to 20, and Mark 9, 38 to 50. So enough to go on with. Let's start with Esther. And I think you and I probably have different responses to this book. I'm really interested in this book in the Bible, partly because it does only appear once in the lectionary, partly because of just the nature of it. It's full of exaggerated, it's a soap opera.
Yes.
It's got extremely questionable events involving beauty pageants and the mistreatment of women and murder and drunkenness and intrigue.
Mm.
God doesn't appear in it
explicitly,
in any explicit way.
Yep.
So part of me, folks, would think, oh, while By the Well will offer excellent episodes for the next couple of weeks, maybe I'll focus on Esther in some depth. But then Sally might not agree that that's the way to go. So shall we start with maybe the setting and the date for this story or this book?
Go for it.
So it's written 100 years after the Babylonian exile.
Mm.
So it's written in a time when perhaps there's much less expectation of going to the Promised Land or going home or returning.
Mm.
So this is a story, as it says at the beginning, of the diaspora.
Mm.
And I suppose that's one of the riches of it is how do you exist as diaspora without capitulating to assimilation and forgetting your cultural identity.
And it kind of already paints that context that it's a vulnerable setting too. So it's not just that we're there in a new place. It's still like things could switch really quickly and we could be literally in danger of our lives being taken.
Exactly, yeah. So we're in Susa, so one of the capitals of the Persian Empire, which had a significant diaspora community. So
I think part of the story is seeking to give an explanation for this Jewish festival, the Festival of Purim, or, you know, the Festival of Lots. And so it's like a story that weaves together a whole background for then going, that's why we celebrate this. So that's important for us to remember. This is all about giving some context for some liturgy. The context is also about this king who's pretty questionable, he's not Jewish, he's pretty into his
status
and power, and it begins with this horror that his wife, after drinking for several days, he and his mates, his wife won't come in when he says come in and show how beautiful you are, so she's an object to be fawned upon or for him to be celebrated for, and she won't. And
good on her.
Yeah, she's amazing. She gets kicked out because of it, but because he's terrified and his courtiers are terrified that this will mean that other women will take a lead from her and stand up
resist
to the abuse of their husbands. So that's the context. I mean, it's wild as a context. I think for me, part of the wondering about preaching from it is that it's so, even though it's short, it's really complex and it has all these layers going on of sexism and racism and understandings of how God is at work in this situation or not, and how you would try and preach on that for 10 minutes, even over a couple of weeks or 15 minutes, however long people are preaching for. That's what is my wondering. And I think the fact that the lectionary just gives us this tiny little slab.
A violent, awful part of the narrative, not the banquet that Esther puts on anything like that.
So I'm not saying that I'm not suggesting that people should. I mean, obviously people will make their own decisions. I'm not saying it's like a hard rule you shouldn't. But how to hold that space well, I think, is the real trick. Because even though it is kind of almost comedic in its melodrama and everything. At heart, it is a story, and trigger warning, like it's about sexual slavery and about women having very little power to have agency over their own bodies and lives. And so within that context, Esther is able to disrupt some of that in order to not only protect herself but protect her people. But that setting is the setting. Mm. And so what do we do with texts when they, in a sense, legitimate that this is okay?
Mm. Mm. One thing I want to point out, it's a well-known resource, but I think it's really helpful. So that's the Bible Project on YouTube. Does a really excellent summary of the whole story, folks. So if you haven't taken a look at Esther before and you want a big picture aerial view with a few key theological points made, we'll put a link to that 10-11 minute clip in the show notes. And the second thing would be the Bratzos series actually has a reasonable commentary on it with on it's Esther and Daniel together, and it's Sam Wells and another author I can't remember.
Yeah.
But I think he really does ask some hard questions about how we got it in the canon, or well, the fact that we've got it. What does it say about God, or what does it say about the gospel vista? That's my language that would be missing. What would we be missing if we didn't have it? So those sort of, I think one way to go in and preach it, if you were to devote a couple of weeks, is those big things. So you come at it with a, not a remotely dismissive, but a critical view of what might this be saying about salvation?
Oh, so they're great questions. And I think there's, like, one of the things that I love about the character, obviously also as a backdrop, I think it's kind of playing with those notions that are often in First Testament text about while Israel might be the smaller power, through faithfulness and God's support, they're able to disrupt. So obviously fleeing Egypt, but other, you know, David and Goliath, other kinds of stories like that. It's the same kind of motif, and it is fantastic that a woman is the central character. But one of the things that I think maybe it provides a little hint about, and I'm not sure that we're that good at it, this aspect, is that Esther doesn't rush into action. Mm. Like first she seeks some counsel, but then she sits with it, and then she fasts and prays for several days, and she invites the community around her to do the same. I love that. Like, so this is danger. Like, they'd have a date for when everyone's going to be killed, all of the people, all of her people, but she stops and waits and prays. And that was the first thing that really struck me. Then the other thing that really struck me was she uses the structures of power that the king uses, so feasting and praising, that kind of context, to then flip the power.
Yeah, and Sam Wells calls that an over-accepting, and that's what happens biblically a lot. Jesus does it a lot when he's questioned about something. So he actually does it on the divorce question as well. That, you know, goes beyond what the question is and shifts it around.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she's doing that. There's those reversals happening in the story all the way through. I must admit, I did think of other stories of escape, like the Hebrew midwives.
Yeah.
And I also think, and this is one of the things I think probably Sam points out, that in our history, modern history, it is important to read this book because what is happening in this book essentially happened.
Mm.
I mean, happened more successfully, in inverted commas, than happened in this story in the Holocaust.
Exactly.
And so we must sit with this.
I agree, and I agree, yeah.
What do we do with that as Christians?
And when we can see that in Australia anti-Semitism is on the rise again, our absolute commitment to Jewish brothers and sisters to stand against that and to acknowledge that that is part of the reality of being Jewish is often to be targeted, both not just in the Holocaust but in ongoing attacks and so on. So I think that's really important.
And I was reading, I was doing some online volunteer work to do with digitising concentration camp forms earlier this year, but it got me into some biographies, and there's a fantastic, I mean, you know, how I escaped Auschwitz, it's called, and it is the story of a Slovakian Jew and his friend who escape after 22 months, and the story is unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, you know, the hiding in a woodpile in the actual camp for four days before the dogs stop looking for them, and, you know, but to go and warn, and he was responsible for several hundred thousand people not being killed because he went out and he crossed on foot to Hungary to tell them what was happening. Amazing. And so on. So, yeah. You know, these stories resonate through history. So there's something about that element of Esther that I find really powerful.
Absolutely.
But it also there's a lack of moral sort of lecturing in it as well. Like all these people, I mean, we've said they're doing terrible things, but there's nothing said.
No, there's not
about,
a critique.
There's no commentary about that, which is interesting.
I feel like there's a tiny hint at something, but it's so that, you know, Queen Vashti's kicked out because she won't obey. And here is the Esther, the central character, who on one level is obeying, like she looks really supportive and everything else, but at the same time she's flipping the whole thing. So there is a kind of playing, but it's not a critique.
No, no.
But there is something at work in that.
Yeah. Now, we haven't gone close into the text for this. Do you think that matters? I don't think I had anything particularly about translation questions or...
No, I think reading the whole story is a good thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And then sitting without... The one thing, though, I would say is if you were thinking about preaching from it, just remembering that, and I know people will, well, many people will know this, but, you know, one in three women have been through sexual abuse and one in six or seven men. And so if you're going to start talking about sexual violence and so on, to have an incredibly pastoral heart about how you do that and make that a safe space for people, because particularly when you come to church, you're coming from a really often a very open-hearted space or a quite nervous space about what are they going to do at church. It's not like going to a lecture where you can just easily walk out or tune out. So just to be really sensitive about that.
Yeah, Robin and I did talk about that with regard to the Bathsheba
story absolutely. Quite a bit.
So yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay. Perhaps we'd better move on to the next.
Yeah, sure.
So that's James.
Good old James. I love James.
Now, do you want to kick off with what you love about this one?
Oh, well, I love the whole letter of James. Yeah. And last week, Sean and I were talking about authorship, that it's obviously a really early text and that it's attributed to the brother of Jesus. It may come from that source or from some other early church writers, but it's very grounded text. And what I like about this passage about prayer, or a couple of things I like. One is there's an assumption that that is part of the practice of discipleship, that we're praying for others, and it's not just the one appointed leader. So, you know, the church structures aren't like that.
No, it's communal.
It's the communal thing. And I also love this reference to oil, and that's something that we use in worship and, well, not online obviously, but when we're face-to-face, but also when I'm visiting people, not just when they're dying. Like there's an invitation, would you like an anointing with oil? I think there's something really profound about kind of three-dimensional practices that aren't just about words.
Yeah, no, that's really powerful. There's lots of different sorts of praying referred to here.
Yes.
Healing, confession, praise.
Yeah. The sense that it's ongoing.
Yes.
Probably we should talk about healing because I think this is the one that can be so misused and abused in the church. People being told whether you didn't get over your diagnosis because you didn't pray hard enough.
Yeah, and I was saying this to Sal before we pressed record, folks, that I was quite surprised in a few of the commentaries or resources I had a look at around this passage. Nobody said tackle that issue that seems to me fairly glaring in this passage. If you pray, what you're praying for will come about. And now he actually says a lot more than that.
Yeah.
And it is more nuanced than that.
Yeah.
But that's not what's heard.
No, it's not.
And, you know, when you hear news stories like I did last week, about the discovery, fortunately, of this lost boy and he'd been found, the news reader, you know, said the family were praying and their prayers were answered.
Yeah.
Well, probably on a very superficial level, yes, that's what happened. But that's so questionable.
It is for all the people who didn't, their babies didn't come home, you know, or children. So I think I think this is a real opportunity, though, to talk about this with people. So to talk about... maybe thinking about how we were brought up with prayer, because often there's a shopping list of doom, like in prayer, you know, pray for this person, this person, this person, fix them up now. And then it leaves people with this, there's kind of only two consequences, God is deaf or God can't act, or no, three consequences, or I've not prayed right or done right. So I think helping people unpack that really simplistic, unhelpful stuff is important. So talking about healing can come in many forms. It might be working towards forgiveness or strength to carry it or people journeying with you. And also that notion that's in the Gospels but also in other places like in Romans, Revelation about Jesus weeping before Lazarus has died, so the space of grief as well as healing. Like he knows he's about to raise him, but he still stops and cries. And in Romans, Paul invited people to pray, to weep with those who weep and to rejoice, so that sorrow and things not being healed is part of our faith as well. And just being, you know, helping, and in Revelation, you know, the sense of God knowing our tears, inviting people into a bigger conversation about what prayer is and what happens in prayer and why we might pray. So one of the ways I talk about it in my parish setting is some people are visual, some people are not, but imagining like being a portal for divine energy. So, you know, God is everywhere and moving with all people, but if you intentionally open yourself up to that healing light, it can move through you to those settings. And people might be open to it or not, and we might never see the consequences of that prayer or not, but it's not about trying to convince God to act. God is already on the side of those who are grieving and wants to be involved in the healing, but it's about collaborating with God in that.
Mm. That's interesting because earlier in the series on James, I did talk about how we understand God to be some sort of motivator to action often in how we understand the faith. And that's how people dismiss James, that's what he's, you know, advocating.
Yep.
When God is actually the reconciling actor with us and through us in how James writes Isaiah see it.
Yeah.
But we do this whole, it's that faith works thing which comes back in all the time, that we very starkly go, oh, well, you know, proves God's there if I do this, or shows I believe or whatever.
Yeah, rather than that kind of organic, I keep thinking when I've been reading James about a river, like it's stepping into the river of God and letting that flow through us into our actions, into our prayers, not bringing God out as a magic trick, not trying to convince God or earn our place or anything like that, but just stepping into that energy field.
And encountering faith in the action in that stepping out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that and I love that it's got the reference to the elders, so that, you know, for congregations to think about, how do we as a community, do we actually pray, do we dare pray for each other, or do we just leave that to the minister? Like whether it's in church or in pastoral care or at coffee, or, you know, like actually grounding our faith in prayer.
How would you, so we know in James he talks a lot about our tongues are quite vicious.
Yep.
And that we, silence is better. You know, he talks about being careful of speaking too quickly and not listening. So I don't know, it'd be interesting in a sermon on this particular text around dialoguing with that in James and the call to prayer.
Oh, that's fantastic. Exactly. And so even in little things, like if so my sense is always to ask someone first if they'd like to have a pray, and it's not just as a minister, anybody can do that. And someone, if you ask in a genuine way, people can say, you know, actually I'm just not up for that. But if you don't offer, that might mean that no one prays with that person for 10 years. You know, like I think there's something about being able to be really aware of our speech and the way in which we do it, and then to be able to say if they do want to pray, would you like to pray as well or not? Or should we pray in silence? You know, like actually opening it up to, instead of having some long recitation or taking over, to do that with some real care and integrity and gentleness.
Yeah, so that sort of dialogue you might have around prayer in James is also getting back to that biblical wisdom that has undergirded the whole letter.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah,
about this power that's embodied in generosity and gentleness rather than dominating and taking over. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any points of translation or language that we should alert people to here?
Not for me particularly, but not just that sense of like the church structures aren't really established yet. So the elders could just be those who that community is recognising have got some gifts for leadership. So I think we can be a bit, unfortunately we have become a bit clerical in some ways. And so to be able to see the gifts of eldership, leadership within communities, and to help be permission given communities, empowering communities where people can feel able to reach out to one another in care, I think that's really important.
Well, I think the mutual confession that happens here is really interesting as well, because we don't often think of confession in that way.
Yeah. How powerful is that?
Yeah. I'm wondering just one phrase, sort of, with the prayer of the faith will save the sick, and we've talked about how that's going to be problematic, and the Lord will raise them up. I'm just wondering, that can mean, you know, literally raising off a bed, but is that a possibly eschatological phrase, so that actually when we read that verse we need to be careful, because it's promising what we already know to be true, that Jesus has come and risen and we will rise with him. And so when we pray that with anybody, but with the sick, we know it's true. So, you know, that grounds this prayer so that it's not promising wishes and things we can't promise.
Yeah, beautiful. And it's so it's a got a bigger picture in mind, so that being reconciled in God and at the great feast and healed and whole is the final place to be, whether it's in whether we experience some of that in this life or in life beyond this life. Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find a link at our website, bythewell.com.au.
And so we come to our gospel this week, Mark 9:38-50. Well, Sally?
Yes. So this is part of this ongoing conversation. Now, I really think we're supposed to laugh because the disciples have totally missed everything that Jesus has been saying. And if you do read this whole section out loud with some other people, you probably will start laughing because Jesus had just said, you know, who's the greatest? And I'm going to suffer because I've been fighting about who's the greatest. And, you know, the child among you is where you find me and where you meet God. So it's in the ones you consider the least. And instead of going, oh, okay, let's think about that. And then they start fighting about who's in and who's out. Like they seriously still, so they've shifted that argument about power just slightly from I'm the best or you're the best to, well, they can't be part of us. So we're still the best because they can't. Like it's ridiculous, but it's utterly human. That's what churches do all the time.
Well, I was going to say it's ridiculous and yet we can see us. It's a mirror of
it is.
What we do.
It is such a mirror of what we do. And so praise be to God that Jesus doesn't say, well, that's it, I've had enough and just leave them all. Jesus stays in relationship with them and continues the conversation. So that's the broader setting for this. And then there's this really interesting conversation about the little ones. Now, the majority view would be that this is a metaphor for those who are young in their faith or the vulnerable in the community or the struggling or whatever. That probably might be the case, but I think that it's a bit convenient to not actually read it within the wider context where Jesus has just been talking about children and he's about to talk about children again. And so for me, because children have continued to be minimized in the church to a certain extent, I think reclaiming that as part of it, the reading is really important here.
And that's radical for the time, wasn't it?
Oh,
because
my word.
Children weren't considered. I mean, now we know about the psychology of children. Yeah. We know really super important things about development and what happens terribly when that's interrupted.
That's right.
Like we are a much more child-centered,
much more now
world.
Yeah,
but back then they were sort of not even were they mini adults? Not even,
not
perhaps.
Really. So in Greco-Roman context, if you're wanting to say don't be a fool, like it'd be like don't be like a child. Mm. Like that's the kind of analogy. So that if you're a child, you're silly, you're not as important, you're not mature, and to be a real man, because it often takes a written men writing to other men, you need to grow up. So that's the kind of, so Paul uses that kind of analogy in 1 Corinthians, and it's in other places too. So yeah, Jesus is doing really radically disruptive stuff by first saying, this is where you meet me and this is where you meet God, like the one who sent me in the earlier passage. And now Jesus returns to this topic of children, which is really interesting here, and talks about, I just want to read this because I just think it's so profound if we think about it. So he uses all this radical language, like kind of Jewish extreme language about cut limbs off if you're stuffing up. Like this is a call to radical kind of purity and integrity. And then says, I just need to find the section. Have you got it there in front of you?
I have.
Yeah, go for it, Fran.
Which bit do you want? If you put if any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believe in me, it would be better if you got you, if a great millstone were hung around your neck, etc.
Yeah.
And you were thrown into the sea.
Now, I love this. I love the fury. I hear fury in this. And I think particularly across the worldwide church, as we are reeling from the abuse of children, to have a text where Jesus is talking about incredibly extreme consequences for those who hurt children, who cause a stumbling block for children, that gives me great comfort.
Well, hell is mentioned three times. Is that – what is the word of you? I'm asking
I've got my Greek here.
Yeah, yeah. What that actually
it
is.
It possibly is Gehenna.
It often, oh, yes, it is Gehenna.
So Gehenna is the rubbish dump, literally the rubbish dump outside the city. So when people – so we need to know that. It's not the fiery place of our imagination.
Yeah, no.
So, So where rubbish is thrown out, it was often on fire. So let's try and hold our image. Yeah. Because it's easy to go down that track. So I'm not talking about, you know, cast out forever, but I am talking about God being really furious with those who hurt children, and the one at the centre of our faith, Jesus, saying that I'm more than happy. I share the fury, and I'm really happy that it's there.
So for me, the emphasis is from this whole passage. So it starts off with disciples being taught and admonished to understand that God's movement and God's healing and God's spirit occurs outside their 12 community and therefore outside the church.
Yes.
And that's super important to underline.
Praise be to God.
But at the same time, within the community, this is where you will find your stumbling blocks and those who will preach bad news and, well, I mean, do the dreadful things you're talking about here, but also in a bigger picture, who will be a block to faith and to God's life-giving word.
Yeah. It's not exactly, and it's not all just so, everything be awesome together. It's like actually step up. Like,
yeah. It's sort of apostasy. Now, I was interested reading Ched Myers in his now somewhat dated book, but I still find very powerful, about Binding the Strong Man.
Yeah.
Talking here about this amputation thing, he would say in his book, is kind of a liberalizing force, because the offense would have been meted out with death. And so this is actually
not as extreme.
Not as extreme.
Mm.
And the salt and the fire that's mentioned here, salt and fire was used to cauterize amputations in ancient medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are all to be, I mean, this is where you start going, are we getting a bit metaphoric and mixing our metaphors?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That we are all required to be salted and fired, because we all have parts of us individually and as a community that deserve to be or have been amputated.
I agree. So I think that's really important.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I'll focus on children, absolutely, and actually it's Child Safety Week. Oh, well, it won't be by the time this text comes, will it? But, you know, this would be a great text to have then.
And the vulnerable.
But, you know.
Absolutely. Going back to the fire thing, I write about this in the new book. So it's people are not sure what is going on with this text, because it says everyone will be salted with fire, and then in some texts it's about sacrifice as well. My take on that is actually that it could well be looking back to Old Testament, First Testament practices that are discussed around sacrifice, where you salted the sacrifice. And so in that context, I think in this whole passage, if it's held together, because it ends by saying be at peace with one another. That's the kind of punchline. So this notion that in order to be at peace with one another, it's not all going around pretending everything's fine and putting up with terrible behaviour. It's about doing that much more
taxing work.
Yeah, really exhausting work of calling to account other people and letting yourself be called to account, letting stuff, like, it's a sacrifice, you know, and to be let our whole lives, which is, you know, picked up in Hebrews, be a sacrifice, but not just of thanksgiving as in Hebrews, but here about living in peace and making these really costly calls on other people and letting it be challenging for ourselves about our behaviour, so that we're not doing the power grabs, which is what the disciples are doing. So we're not trying to exclude people beyond the community or put ourselves first. Like that's the work of major heart transformation and ego transformation. Like that's costly.
It's humility.
It's humility. It's a sacrifice. Yeah. And I think that's how the genuine peace is achieved. So it's holding those. So being salty is about being refined, like burnt, you know, in the fire.
So something I did read, and I've only got a vague recollection, but yeah, the Old Testament imagery of salt was around fellowship. Is that all? But it's really covenant, is it?
Thanksgiving sacrifices would have been salted. So, and there are a couple of different examples of that. So, I mean, I think, you know, these metaphors can have multiple layers, but I think in the first century, when this is being written out largely for Jewish communities, that sense of salt and sacrifice would have made much more sense for people, and about staying salty. Yeah.
Mm. Which, if you do think about, if it were a medical thing to do, it's deep healing that's actually going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah.
Well, I think that's a good point on which to end.
Great.
Thanks for listening, folks.
Thanks.
By the Well has been recorded on Wurundjeri land. It's produced by Adrian Jackson and brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia.